Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
February 23, 2023. No, I'm not stuttering. It is Thursday, and the O'Shelly Effect is indeed live. This is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you found it. And if you weren't looking for it, I don't know what the hell you're doing with your computer or your phone, because it's hard to find unless you're looking for it, okay? I know we're out there. We're broadcasting 24/7, replaying the shows. We got 5 video channels, none of them called YouTube. But, you know, it is what it is. Podcast galore going out to many, many different places. A whole bunch of places with audio podcasts, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, we are hard to find on the internet, supposedly. Anyway, I would say allegedly, but I don't want to wear out Jack's word. I know he uses it all the time, and you just heard Jack Blood. And proof positive that I do not control what my hosts say. Because if I did, I would have interrupted that show a couple of times on the JFK topic, okay? Anyway, if you don't know what I'm talking about, catch his podcast as well. And here we go. I will be live tomorrow night also. And starting in March, we're going to have a regular replay schedule, which we're going to replay some old shows that a lot of you guys missed, because there was a time when I had like 5 listeners when I started. Actually, it was about 10 or 11 listeners, I think, the first night I went live. You know, only a few people downloaded the podcast and all that good stuff. And the original podcasts, I didn't even know where to put them, so whatever. But we might replay a whole bunch of that stuff and put it back out there, because it's worth going back over. And a guy who's been with me a lot, even since the earliest of days, Larry Hancock is with me tonight. Now, if you don't know who Larry Hancock is, welcome to my show, welcome to Planet Earth. Welcome to politics and welcome to the JFK assassination. We're not going to talk about the JFK assassination tonight, I don't think. It won't be necessary. Because we have other political things and historical things to discuss. Larry Hancock is an author. Go to larry-hancock.com. Take a look at his blog. I'll give you the link to that. I'll give you the link to some of his books in the show notes for sure, and maybe some reference points for tonight's show, because we are talking current events, and we're talking about something that I am getting rather exhausted with, quite frankly. But you know, is it relevant? Could it be the coming war? Is it the Cold War? Is it a hot war? Is it something because, Putin came out and said that he was going to, maybe not abide by nuclear treaties and things. And that was the point from like a 2-hour speech that the media decided to focus on. But is there a lot more to be focused on? Is there a lot more noteworthy, meaning you should take note of it? Indeed, there is. The conflict in Ukraine. Is it being represented properly in the mainstream media? Well, talk about a, what do you call that, an oxymoron? Okay, maybe I'm an oxymoron, but the thing is, is the mainstream media telling you the truth or representing it properly? Of course not. It doesn't matter what country you're in or what corporation is providing it to you, or if it's being sponsored by Pfizer or not. Of course they're not. Is the alt media doing you a favor? Cheerleading for Russia, most of them? Probably not. I love the fact that a place that fired me is getting a lot of play with some other alt media. I can see what they were doing. And they fired me for, oh my goodness, being somewhat sympathetic to people affected by the war in Ukraine. But am I on board with the mainstream narrative? No. Am I on board with Joe Biden's posturing and ridiculousness with his recent visit? No, I'm not. Here's the thing. I think it's all dirty. I think war itself is a crime, no matter who is actually committing it. But I'm not allowed to say that. Unless it's on my own platform, my own network, my own show. And I brought Larry Hancock to drag him into this fray and get his view on it, because Vladimir Putin gave an interesting speech and all that. And of course, many, many books by Larry Hancock that I could point to right behind me on my bookshelf if I wanted to. He takes up more space than any other author, and rightfully so, on my personal bookshelf. One of those books over there is called Creating Chaos. Might have something to do with tonight's discussion. There's a lot of other books on there. Surprise Attack, Shadow Warfare, Well, let's see, The Awful Grace of God, Killing King. I mean, there's a whole bunch over there. Someone would have talked. What else is over there? I don't know. You know what? There's a bunch of them. And you can check all that stuff out. I mean, you can get Larry's stuff on Amazon. I'll give you some other links, too. To go get it, if you don't have it, you need it. Because it is all about the behavior of the national security state, the political context, the historical context. Really a sober and excellent author all the way around on a lot more than just the political assassinations. But don't discount that either. Larry Hancock, sorry for the long introduction. How you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing okay, Chuck. Still waiting for spring, but other than that, fine.
Waiting for spring, and are you waiting for the other shoe to drop in this, it's a propaganda war, it's a psychological war, it's a war, it's a thing going on, and yes, indeed, Vladimir Putin is at the center, the villain in so many narratives out there. In the corporate media, absolutely. Is he a villain? Well, not sure. Is he a hero? I don't think so. You know, is the president, oh man, Zelensky, right? The guy who is, I think the title is president of Ukraine. Anyway, doesn't matter. Head of the government, the guy who used to be a comedian on TV. How dare they put a guy who used to have a reality TV show on out as their president somewhere else? I mean, oh, wait a minute. We kind of did that here, I guess, huh? Okay, I'm sorry. I digress and digress again. I'm doing this to be sarcastic because my point of view is not really important tonight. I want to take a look at what it is you are seeing. And we were treated the other day to a general address by Vladimir Putin to the, what do they call that in Russia? Is there... I guess their version of Congress, so to speak, right? I mean, for, you know, in translation here, there is a body, a governing body that he was addressing, right? And this is something that the president of Russia does, the Russian Federation, right? It's a normal thing, but a fairly lengthy and, extensive address covering a lot of different topics. And, of course, like I said, the mainstream media really wanted to focus on the end notes, if you will, regarding nukes and things like that. Some people want to make a point that they can't discuss the Clash of Civilizations comments. Oh, why did I categorize it that way? I didn't mean to. The stuff about, you know, the liberalism of the West and how he doesn't want it to infect Russia. And their values and so on. And I've actually gotten multiple emails about how Vladimir Putin is actually talking about real values that are important. He's a good guy, you know. And isn't it so sick, the condition that the West is in? And I don't disagree that we are at a point of political and social ills in the West that needs to be addressed and is not being properly addressed. But at the same time, I don't believe that Vladimir Putin is anybody's savior. Of course, I'm not Russian. And I don't blame the Russian people for this. And I don't demonize them or even look at the past. And I'm saying all this for a reason, Larry. I'm sorry to take up time. But I don't look at the past psyop that was conducted against my generation for sure to... you know, dehumanize Soviets, to dehumanize the USSR until it fell, right? Right around the time that I was reaching adulthood, it fell. But as a child, you know, there was definitely a Cold War stigma attached to the people of that region, the people behind the Iron Curtain. Sometimes they were victims, but they were also dangerous victims. They were the enemy. They were the boogeyman. A commie might be under your bed, even. And I have a feeling, you're a little older than me, Larry. I have a feeling in your generation there was a version of that as well. I don't adhere to that. I don't believe I'm influenced by it. But I'm skeptical of Vladimir Putin nonetheless. And not because of the Soviet tie, but because of many other things I see. Anyway, again, my point of view, not really important. I want to break down what was said in this speech and the general... circumstance that we find ourselves in, because the propaganda mill is really heated up well and at hard at work regarding what you're supposed to think, what you're supposed to see, who it is you're supposed to be rooting for, why it is we should sign off on sending money over there, why it is we should sign off on being on the side of Ukraine, why it is we should sign off on demonizing the Russians, Vladimir Putin, etc., etc., etc. And I don't know, Larry, I have this tendency to want to call BS on all of it. So I leave it to you to unpack, unravel, reveal for the audience. And is that a tall enough task, Larry?
I was going to say, gosh, where to start? But I think one place to start is we are, especially the media in general, it's changing a little bit. I think we are probably too focused on Putin. And we're not focused on what has evolved. If I do see bits and pieces here of what is actually within Russia getting to be a very basic story. It comes from Putin's predecessor. I mean, Putin's predecessor has always been more radical than Putin in terms of what you referred to as a culture conflict, as Russians' moral prerogative, as Russia's sphere of influence. He was saying things that Putin only started to say in the last year or so.
Right.
And he was saying it before Putin came into office. If you look at the head of the Wagner Group, he is saying things that are far more radical than Putin was saying at the beginning, especially at the beginning of this so-called special operation. A year ago, Putin was talking about a special operation simply to protect Russian-speaking, Russian-culturally-oriented individuals in the breakaway areas of Ukraine. I mean, that was it. It's going to be a military operation. They're constantly being attacked. They're insecure. We need to come to their defense. And that's what it was. He wasn't talking, you know, ethics and morals and religion and, you know, Russia versus the West. It was a special military operation to protect what were essentially Russian citizens that had been kind of abandoned. And Chuck, there certainly this, we've seen that sort of thing before. I mean, that's the way Adolf Hitler started. And I'm, you know, you need to face up to the fact that in the beginning it was, oh, we need to protect the Russian speakers in this one little small section of Poland or this in Austria. Yeah, same line. No, let's conquer the world thing. And then as things evolved, it became a much broader mission.
Well,
and that's where we are now.
If you look
at his speech,
right,
it's a much broader mission against defending Russia against the West, which
right,
is what his predecessor was saying and what the head of Wagner is saying,
right,
that it is really and has always been a culture war, and now we need to bring that up front.
Indeed. Now, let me push on you a little bit here, and I don't usually do this, Larry, but I have to. Here's the thing. I want to know from your point of view if this is, well, typical, let's say, in historical context, because often what I see, and I don't like going straight to Hitler. I didn't like even hearing you just do it, okay? Because, you know, there's a lot there to unpack, and there's a lot of controversy over going straight to that. I would not readily jump to comparing Vladimir Putin to Hitler. However,
I would. See, there's a disconnect right there.
Yeah, there's absolutely a serious disconnect. Now, but here's the reason why I don't jump straight to him. Because I don't think Hitler's special. I don't think Putin is special. I think that from what I observe, okay, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about Roman history or we're talking about American history or we're talking about, you know, it's irrelevant. Any history of a long-standing nation, and I don't even mean a tremendously long-standing nation. It could only be 100 years that a nation is a nation. The nation of Italy, for instance, has not actually existed as a nation all that long. Okay? Studying Italian history, so on and so forth. Okay. What I often see is that consent of the people is often built by a variety of types of leaders, okay, whether they're socialist or they're fascist or they're allegedly democratic or they are indeed democratic or they are populist or they are, you know, social engineers of one type or another. It's almost irrelevant as well what the ism is, what the philosophy is. Often what is seized upon, this is very typical, is, look, you've been victimized. You have been oppressed. The oppressor is clearly not me. I'm using a generic here for the leader, right? The oppressor is not me. The oppressor is someone else. We are in conflict with that someone else. They are an existential threat to you personally, to your values, to our collective good, one way or another. Whether it is a treasure or land or identity. And identity is one of the best ways to go after it. But back to it, it's at stake here because it is under attack. They are seeking to undermine it. They are seeking to destroy it. They are seeking to go to war. They are seeking to murder us. They are seeking to destroy us. This basic principle is universal. It doesn't matter what language it is. It doesn't matter what the opposition is. It doesn't matter how real the existential threat is or is not. Indeed, it is the most popular way to get the consent and participation of the people, so to speak, in whatever national organization you have. And so to me, this just seems like, well, this is what Putin is doing. Now, whether it's a real threat or it is one that is simply encouraged by the religiosity which is most popular or most powerful in said society, or it is just the consensus by earlier propaganda, or it is a continuation of somebody else's plan from earlier, it's almost irrelevant because it is the same methodology that you just can't escape it. Anytime there is a need to get the consent and participation of the people.
Well, see, Chuck, that's where I would dissent. I absolutely agree with you in that general statement.
Okay.
Where I disagree is I don't think this is in line with standard practice.
Okay.
Because to me, and the reason I referred to Hitler is Hitler did not ask, nor did he try to muster popular consent in his first very limited military actions. Neither did Putin. Putin didn't wage a PR campaign to build a huge Russian popular pressure to move against Ukraine. He just gave the order, and the forces moved. And if you recall, the forces that moved, up until the day they moved, Putin was saying, you know, there's no need for war. There's a security issue for these poor folks in eastern Ukraine, but we're not going to invade. We're not. These are military maneuvers for months, right? So he wasn't building any consent, and then he threw the switch, and we found out that many of the troops deployed into Ukraine didn't know that they were in Ukraine. Mm. They still thought that they were in military maneuvers inside Russia. So what the reason I'm disconnecting this from the way that things normally work, as you say, is I do not see that consent process. What I see is actually, and the reason I made the reference to Hitler is a very autocratic, we're doing this, and then after he gets himself immersed into it, the other part of the story evolves. Putin's speech that we heard this week was not at all like the talks that he was giving during the first period of special military operation, which was supposed to be over in days. Now he does. Now that he's gone through two mobilizations into a third mobilization, they've emptied the prisons. Now he has to work on building consent and staying in power, quite frankly. because he's got some contenders. So the reason I pulled it out is, A, I agree with you about the way the world works, but I think this is really a bit of an inception with a leader who makes a decision, commits his military into a large-scale operation, and then has to build support for it.
Okay. Well, that's why I laid it out, because I think it's worthy of mention that this is not atypical. This isn't some shocker in my mind, but what you're saying is equally true. Now, I would say that there was a propaganda campaign and a PR campaign well ahead of this, not specifically about Ukraine. I think that there was an effort, okay, to build popular sympathy, which was successfully done. And I talked about it with you before, where, look, this guy is on the right side of things among a certain group of people. Right. They would see the very conservative, generally conservative, social issue. Don't bring your poison to us. Right. Don't bring your corruption to us. Now, I'm not saying that that's valid or invalid. All I'm saying is that he built sympathy among those people. And now, because people are so untrusting, and they rightfully so, of Western media, the opposition is almost reflexively to think that he's on the right side of things. He's also saying some of the very popular things among those that believe that, you know, society and especially Western culture has become so corrupt and diseased and far afield from what should be regarding values, regarding ethical considerations, that he's literally like a champion of, well, ethics, a champion of returning to proper value systems, things like this. And I think that he found sympathetic ears there among people who, you know, would sympathize with that notion. You know,
I think you're totally right. And I think it, to me, it went through three stages.
Okay.
The first is his first, like, position was not against Ukraine, as you said. It wasn't necessarily even against the, it was against NATO. Mm-hmm. Literally against NATO and NATO / NGOs, you know, the Western institutions, you know, these insidious folks that were trying to put their tentacles, you know, NATO is kind of like the public face of it, but, you know, along with them are all of their commercial establishment. That was the first villain. And that was going on, as we've talked about, that started going on certainly by 2014. And then it was, okay, we have a very particular problem with, they haven't managed to get their tentacles into Russia. I've stopped that. We did a great job of that, but they're still putting their tentacles in, and NATO is going to be using Ukraine against us. Okay, second generation. But then we talked about the fact, I think you've outlined the message that he's using quite well, but it's the message that his people actually learned in their psychological warfare against the West. You know, what memes would work, what things would work on the internet, what social networking, where do you get people to jump on the bandwagon? What do you say to get people in the West to jump on your bandwagon? Right. And if you look at it, yeah, he's the morality, the sexual orientation, the purity of the family are all things that they found to be very successful and working within the political campaign that they wanted to support in the last, you know, previous election. Mm-hmm. Now, they found a space for that, and now he's speaking to that space, to his own people and to us, and it's resonating. And he knows exactly where it's going to resonate because they already trialed it.
Right. Right. I mean, literally, this is already, I mean, it's now well-placed, right? The research has already been done. So you know how this is going to resonate. Now, what I find fascinating is that, again, just like all things anymore, politically or socially or whatever, there is a giant Rorschach test that goes on. You know, regardless of what is spoken or what is actually done, the interpretation absolutely shifts the character of the thing. His speech, interesting. Like I said, they only really seized upon his whole discussion about, well, you know what, the nuclear thing, right? Again, you know, he's going to withdraw from agreements, right? And okay, let's get into the fear porn aspect of that, and let's sell that in the West. Look at how dangerous he is because of that. I think it misses the entire, I don't know, hour and 50 other minutes of the speech. You know, there's a whole lot more there.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so...
Yes. Total agreement.
So talk to me about the overall, I mean, there's an overall message here, yes. But, I mean, are there other specific, honestly, more imperative points in that speech that are made aside from that? Because I think that was almost just a tactical announcement. I think some of these other things are, I think the whole thing is tactical, as these speeches are. But go ahead.
Yeah, I think that, quite frankly, is more of a throwaway. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're absolutely right, and I don't. It's like it continually is trotted out as the elephant in the room, right. But it's not the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room is that he is now trying to rally a nation around a reason to enter into an unending military struggle. The fact that, you know, what was supposed to be a special military operation that would take days, or perhaps, you know, long enough to stabilize the borders and put in Russian troops and make sure that the secessionist provinces in Ukraine couldn't be threatened, you know, how long can that take? Well, they haven't even gotten to the borders yet. So now he's got to step back from that, and it's a year. And how could the strongest or second strongest land-based military on the planet be in a position where now it's embroiled in trench warfare? How could that even happen? You don't want people asking those questions, but somehow he's got to get his nation to commit to essentially a war without end, and a war with no stated endpoint. And so how do you do that? And so he has to fall back on making it a crusade. He has to make it much bigger than Russia is under threat. It's not that we have to defend our Russian speakers in Ukraine. It's that we have to defend the nation. We are under threat. It's an existential, what was a special military operation is now an existential threat to the nation. How does that happen to something that's supposed to be as strong as the Russian nation in 1 year? How could that possibly happen? So that's the rest of the hour and a half rest of his speech is trying to convince the population to keep going forward. I mean, he's going to commit them whether they want, but they need to keep going along and step in march and return to a much more structured, much less open system, you know, to a 5-year plan, whatever is necessary. So that's the real story. And that gets very little mention, as you say, that he is committing the Russian nation not to a cold war, for heaven's sakes, but a hot war. Mm-hmm. To reorient manufacturing, reorient science, to stand still when he does the next mobilization includes the full-time students in the technical and engineering colleges from Moscow. They're going to be putting up with a lot. He needs to have them convinced that this is necessary, not just something good to do, but a survival thing. So that's where he starts introducing the culture warfare aspects that you talked about, which is, strangely enough, the way his predecessor has been talking for some time, the way the guy who heads Wagner, who its name I can never pronounce correctly, so I avoid it, mm-hmm. talks about all the time. They're talking about something much more deadly and such much more brutal, and they're talking about unrestrained warfare. At least he's just talking about continual warfare. Did that make... So, yes, I agree with you, and actually it's a much... To me, it's a much more threatening message, which you do hear. I'm sure people are wondering why are some of the speeches that we're hearing from the West, why are they talking the way they are? And they're responding to that message, not to a nuclear warfare threat. That they're responding to the Russia is now committing itself to a full scale conventional warfare of an undetermined period against whoever goes against them in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and here is the argument, right, that if indeed they are confronted by a fully saturated Nazi regime, okay, on their back door, who is, you know, connected to them geographically, connected to them culturally, and so on and so forth, and is a threat to their safety, well, then they have a right to defend themselves. Now, I know you just laughed, but I'm very...
I laugh because would have to establish that threat. I mean, has anybody demonstrated how in the world Ukraine a year ago was a threat to the Russian Federation militarily?
Well, see, that's the question that I ask, and I'll tell you that people say, well, look, the individuals that were living in certain regions that, first of all, it's a fallacy that they weren't allowed to speak Russian because they spoke both. I've been told this by various people who don't even know each other in Ukraine, that, you know, Ukrainian and Russian were spoken openly everywhere because there is an intermingling here. There is a historical connection not so long ago with the Soviet Union and Ukraine being part of it. Indeed, there was certainly a real Nazi-type group, and indeed the West might have interfered there. In various ways. I mean, what, I'm supposed to be shocked over that? I don't think so. But was there an existential threat to Russia? You know, was there a real threat? Well, they just say, no, it's these people that were living in these regions. They were being abused and terrorized just based on who they were. And that's as far as that seems to go. I mean, and the argument about Crimea and reacquiring that. Well, that was, you know, because that's what the people in Crimea wanted, and that's the way it was advertised. Come to find out, maybe that's not so true. But it is what it is now. And in furtherance of the whole thing, it's just very interesting to me. What was the existential threat to the Russian Federation?
And Chuck, yeah. Were there not, here's, and I realize, as you point out, sometimes I get lost in time and space, but let's say that there was a real threat to those folks. Okay. And in truth, they did succeed, and there was continuing military exchanges. Okay. Yeah. What about some of the solutions that we used to talk about that Russia, as a world power, could have taken to the UN? What about a real demilitarized zone enforced by, the United Nations? What about peacekeepers? What about, okay, if it was just about Luhansk and Donetsk, were there not some alternatives? Because if their rights were being violated, you know, are there no, why wasn't there a public relations campaign to support them, rather than what we do know, which it occurred, was a constant and ongoing transfer of covert Russian military personnel to go in and fight on their side. Now, I won't even argue that they had some legitimate complaints or whatever, but none of that represents an existential threat to Russia, and there could have been other alternatives that they didn't even attempt to pursue as advocates for those regions. Now, maybe nobody else did either, but it was, there were peace accords that were signed, you know, and nobody, Russia signed the peace accords, just like Ukraine did. And so either party could have, you know, called for help, but none of that happened. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to be naive and put forth that there's not an issue there, but I don't see how in the world it was an existential military threat issue for Russia, which should have led them into an ongoing full-scale war, which is, you know, destroying a lot of their population, a lot of their infrastructure, a lot of their workforce, which is which is hurting the country. They're hurting themselves doing it.
Well, right. Now, in this speech, you know, in all fairness, and I'm dealing with it with a translation, right? So I don't speak Russian. I don't understand Russian. Very little, right? So in this speech, in the translation that I looked at and read through, he does suggest that they made peaceful attempts to resolve the situation. And I think at some point he says that they made all peaceful attempts they could. Now, I'm not certain of that. I'm not certain of the characterization there, but I am certain that he suggests that he made peaceful attempts to resolve that circumstance, and it went unheard. It went unanswered by, you know, he characterizes the government in Kiev or Kyiv, depending on who you're listening to. You know, and he says basically they ignored it. They continued to aggressively assault these people. And if that is the case, and he took action, I still ask the question, is this the appropriate reaction if that is indeed the case? Now, look, again, I don't want to muddle your presentation here with my opinion too much. I'm just asking the question. What are your thoughts on that part of the speech? Because I know you read it too, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess my thought is I might be more amenable to that if you and I, if I had not done the research for Creating Chaos, if we had not talked about the actual Russian activities in Crimea and the Ukraine from 2014 on in terms of a military sense, if I wasn't aware of that level of detail, I'd probably be persuaded. Or at least consider it. But knowing the level of military detail I do, I see no evidence that I see a lot of evidence of covert military and overt military engagement. I mean, when the man sent in four brigades of tank forces to waste the Ukrainian army in the east back then, and when asked about it, said, "Well, those people are all on vacation." The Russian troops, by the way, I have problems with those things, but let's ramp it up a bit. And so he took it up with Kiev, and he's trying to be a protector for the Russians and the Russian speakers in the east. And he took it up to Kiev, and they wouldn't answer. Where else did he take it? Did he take it to the UN? Did he take it to the world community and ask, you know, lay out a case and ask for sanctions against Kiev for the brutality that they're demonstrating? I don't recall anything on the international scene that would have indicated that he tried to escalate it with other solutions other than military. Do you recall anything? Because I spent a lot of time looking at it, and I certainly don't recall anything other than military action.
Well, I'm thinking back. I can't recall it either. I can say that, look, simply because I don't recall it or it didn't come out in, you know, international news doesn't mean that it didn't happen. You know, because underreporting or non-reporting of something like that is a possibility.
True.
You know, I'm just saying, look, we often find that there were things that were not reported on previous to an event, and somebody justifies a war, and sometimes that somebody has an American flag on their sleeve, okay? Just saying, that happens too, all right? But I got to tell you, I find no evidence of it either. I do want to take a quick break because I've really knocked a lot of this off balance, and I want to get to more of your analyzation of not only this speech but of the entire situation, and I want to shut up and let you lay out a few things for people because it's very important, and I think that, unfortunately, this does not bode well for some things in the near future. Of course, people are talking about the alliance between the Russian Federation and China. And, of course, China is our other existential boogeyman right now. I mean, look, I'm not even taking seriously the idea of the new, you know, we got to fight the commies, Cold War paradigm that's being pushed. I believe that's being pushed by the Western media. I believe it's being pushed by spheres of influence that go beyond media. But, of course, that is their tool that they're utilizing to impress it upon, you know, common idiot like me. Not saying like you, Larry. See, I didn't put you in that group. I'm common idiot. That's fine. But I do believe that this is being intentionally marketed to people like myself who might be concerned, who might actually worry about this kind of thing, who might think about it. Anyway, we're going to think about the entirety of the situation a little more and put it in context. A lot more with my guest Larry Hancock on the Ocelli Effect. It might be a slightly shorter show tonight, but there's going to be a lot of info and analysis to be had. Stick around, guys.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools.
Why?
The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs and Nation Building in Southeast Asia, by author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs and Nation Building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War, by author Mike Swanson.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
When a fan of the Ocelli Effect calls in to the Ocelli Effect.
I just wanted to call in and tell you and Michael Swanson and JT Sicilian, all of the guests that you have, how much I love your show. Always interesting. It's always informative. I just wanted to tell you in person on the phone, I mean, I love you. I love your show. I love everything you do. I will always be there to support you. You know that.
We appreciate you so much. You have okay. No idea.
Thanks. And most of our fans just send hate mail and death threats.
Shelly.com.
Revelation through conversation.
I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. You're going to have mental depression for people. You're going to have...
Ocelli.com.
Second segment of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com, and glad to have you along with us and our guest, Larry Hancock. We have discussed the international community's view of the recent speech by Russian leader Vladimir Putin and, of course, the conflict in Ukraine, unavoidable in that discussion. Although I would say that speech is a great deal more in focus for the domestic audience, obviously. Despite the fact that there were many signals intentionally planted, I think, there for the international community to seize upon. But again, go to Larry-Hancock.com, take a look at the many, many books he's written, his blog. I know he's touched upon this in his blog before, maybe not this specific thing, but who knows, coming soon, so go and check it out. Again, I want to shut up a lot more here during this segment and get the rest of what we should be seeing from this very interesting speech, because I gotta say, look, I could comment on the ridiculous rhetoric coming from President Joe Biden's mouth, right? The cheerleading, the excited utterance, okay, that went on with Poland, and suddenly we're very, very concerned about how we stand with the Polish people. Now, look, I'm not trying to make a joke out of anything here, but you know, the actions by NATO in the past might have provoked some of what we see here that is now being signaled by Vladimir Putin. Indeed. But does it account for all of it? And does it account for what he's feeding to his domestic audience? Because that is really the focus of that speech that was given. I'll give you guys the link to that speech in tonight's show notes, and I'll try and get it over to the chat room at Ocelli.com. But mainly, I want to get Larry Hancock's take on it as best we can. Because, again, Larry, I don't think you speak Russian, do you?
I do not.
Okay, so you're working with a translation like I am, but I found some striking words in there. And you and I talked about the Wagner Group, and the Wagner Group talking about the leader. Again, I won't make an attempt at his name either. But, you know, here we go. He's talking about treason and traitorous notions. Funny thing, Vladimir Putin used the word traitor and talked about traitors and people that worked outside of the Russian sphere of influence who are Russian and how they're paying a price for it now, economically, politically, etc., directly oligarchs losing some of their wealth. But there's a lot more to that story and the majority of this two-hour-long speech that Putin gave was directed at the domestic audience, the Russian people, so and Russian leadership, and etc. So I just turn it over to you to tell us what was contained in there, because, well, quite frankly, I don't think anybody else is talking about it. So go ahead.
I think your point earlier was right on, Chuck, that our media tends to react to, you know, what was there about us and focus on the nuclear aspect. That speech as a whole, in toto, was essentially an address to the Russian people. He's not going to do something stupid and really dive into the special military operation that turned out not to be what it was expected to be and not to succeed like it was expected to. So he would have liked to address that on the anniversary, but instead he's got to tell his nation that they are literally, quite frankly, now at war existentially with the West, and that they are going to be living in a wartime regime. Now, this is kind of a difficult task for anybody, because you're essentially saying, okay, nobody overtly attacked us. You know, we have not, there no forces have invaded us. This is no, you know, that's not happened, but you are at war, and we're going to expect you to behave as if you were. If you show any sympathy or act in any way supportive of those who we're facing off against, which quite frankly is the West, people that a large part of Russia have been buying products from and going to on vacations in and really linked to socially or culturally, you know, that's off limits now. We're at war with them, and you need to pay attention to that, because if you say the wrong thing at the wrong time, you'll be considered to be a traitor.
Just for the record, I think you and I would both agree that there is a tremendous valley of distance, a tremendous divide between how we might view the Russian leadership and the Russian people. I mean, I even in the days when I was being taught, when I was being drilled with the idea, I believe, in school and in the media and in political circles and so on and so forth, that, you know, the Soviet Union as a whole was this giant, you know, evil thing. I always thought that there was a tremendous separation between the people and the actions of the government and the actions of their agencies, right? So I always thought that I wouldn't want to judge the Russian people based on what it is the government or the leaders did. As I hope, although I know it's not always true, as I hope that the world does not necessarily judge, you know, all Americans based on what our government has done allegedly in our name. You know, similar thing, right? So I would say there's a separation there. I just wanted to note that, Larry. I'm sorry. I didn't want to interrupt, but I think it's important to note that as we go forward here, because this is about Putin addressing the people, not necessarily the people being wholly responsible for this, even in my mind. So,
well,
go ahead.
Yeah, and he's trying to set, and he's got to condition them. I mean, the Russian nation, the individual people they abandoned the Soviet Union, they abandoned communism, they abandoned the kind of restrictions that there were, they really, you know, for a number of years, they considered themselves to have a free press. They considered, you know, free speech. They reached out to the West. The West was not considered to be evil any longer, as you're saying. You know, that's gone. That's the past.
Right.
And that's the Russian people as a whole thought that was fine, and they were good with it. And now he's having to adjust them to that's. Those rules are no longer in play. You no longer have those options, whatever you might think. And I've seen a lot of interviews and quotes, whatever you might have thought, these are the new rules of the game. I mean, we have an example of a young married couple talking about a Russian defeat in a restaurant, being arrested because someone at the next table reported them to the police. You know, that's what you expected under the Soviet regime. That's the kind of control that existed. And Putin, if he's mobilizing his nation for a kind of an unending war, he's laying down these rules. So that's a large part of his address, is to reset from where they were a year ago, where, quite frankly, we have the surveys. A year ago, the Russian population didn't think Russia was going to war. They didn't think, nobody thought this was going to happen. So this is a shock. That's why so many of them left quickly. So yeah, he's got a lot, he's got a, major reorientation to do. And he had to be very hard-nosed about it, and that's where when he introduces the word traitor, I mean, he's telling them how much the game has changed. But while he is doing that, at the same time, for the larger domestic picture, you know, he's facing the fact that he has allowed a very dangerous situation to grow within the Russian military, where he has a large private military force totally under the direct command of one person. No command infrastructure, there's one guy calling the shots about where they go and where they fight. And that guy had some success, interestingly enough, because he was close to Putin. Everybody thought he was tied to Putin. And so for the first months of this conflict, he was getting all the ammunition, all the transport, all the infrastructure he wanted. And his people were having some success. The Wagner Group was having success.
Right.
They have stalled out. They're not getting the same level of support, and he's very upset with it. And now this fellow is referring to the entire Russian regular military as traitors. And he's actually, I mean, and he's publicizing this. Who would imagine a year ago that you had got to have the Wagner Group on its official internet political channel showing pictures of its troops taking machine gun practice with the commanders of the Russian army's pictures being on the targets? Mm. I mean, that in itself would have to be considered treason, but that's not the kind of treason Putin is talking about. It's the kind of treason the guy who was once considered to be his number one guy is talking about. So you got multiple people talking about treason. This is a very dangerous situation. And what about the Russian military? Chuck, I've got to point out, one of the questions that we're constantly asked is, how in the world can this war end? Mm. Well, I have to ask everyone to think, how did World War I end? Mm. What was the crux? What took Russia out of Imperial Russia out of World War I? It was revolts within its military structure. The Navy, then the Army. You know, at some point in time, if you ask your military to, you know, constantly lose tremendous amounts of forces with no obvious need, there may be a problem. So there are a lot of domestic issues at play in Russia right now, which I think were on Putin's mind in configuring that speech, which he has to address that he can't address publicly. You know, he can't say that. So it's a real challenge. I'm thinking to myself, how would you like to tell everybody that you just started something that was supposed to be over in 2 weeks, and now you're going to have to go back and tell them they're in an unending full-scale military campaign? How do you even do that? That's what his speech was about.
Mm. Well, I think that's why it is by necessity. You have to introduce the, you know, look, I'm not trying to make a joke here, but let me use humor to introduce the idea anyway. You know, the Blues Brothers were on a mission from God, right? Okay, well, when you do that, when you introduce that into the story, it changes the levels of justification that you can use. And now this is a very serious note, right? If it's a holy war, if it is a righteous struggle that one is involved in, notice the words I'm avoiding using here. If you do that, if that is part of the paradigm, if that is part of the operating principle by which you ask people to sacrifice, you ask people to step into the breach, you ask people to give up their sons and daughters, if it is on that level, you can sustain it for a while, historically. Am I right or wrong?
No, that in fact, that's pretty much your only choice.
Mm-hmm. Right, and
you've got to reach among the beyond the pragmatic, the, you know, that the things that people see staring them in the face, and you've got to take it to high level, higher level to get them to agree to go on because of things that you can't reach out and touch. Well, you know, it has to be a moral imperative, a religious imperative. We're doing this. You have to accept it. It's a crusade. The casualties don't count. It's a higher ethic.
Well, because it's very easy to sustain a long-term military campaign if the casualties are low. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Afghanistan. You can keep it going for 20 years because there's not a lot of body bags coming back. If a lot of body bags start coming back, the people will revolt against it without this element in place. From what I can tell, I mean, again, maybe my study of history is off a bit, but it does seem to me as though you can sustain it a lot longer and offer up a lot more of your youth, your soldiers. You can offer a lot more if you have this as part of the equation, right?
Especially, and the one thing you have to add to that, especially when you're not fighting on your own territory and not obviously involved in self-defense. I mean, that amped up the problem considerably when everybody's looking around and saying, you know, there's nobody here that we're fighting against. We're fighting against somebody over there on their territory. You know, that's another element of the equation. That makes it a little trickier to sustain.
Well, self-defense is a different paradigm from, you know, a war which is elsewhere. I mean, it just is. I mean, self-defense in and of itself is a justification for a lot of things. Right? And I mean, rightfully so.
And rightfully so. And that's, we know that is human nature. Territoriality, that's the way we're built.
Right.
So he's facing that problem too. I'm sure he would love to deal with an actual obvious overt threat. You know, here's a pincer movement 100 miles inside Russia. Okay, now we're cooking, but he doesn't have that.
Right. Well, that would actually, and that's why, I mean, I know some people theorized at the beginning that there might be something that is, you know, that happens there that could be represented as an attack, which is why I thought some months ago, if you remember, there was this possibility that encroachment on Russian territory was going to start to happen. Right? Because suddenly there was a bombing. I mean, it's a little vague to me now, but if you remember, there was, I think missiles were launched into Russian territory. And they
right
said,
across
well,
this... the, yeah, right across the border. I mean, like 10 miles, something like, yeah, but onto Russian soil, yeah, but it was, no forces were committed.
No.
You know, it was like a missile strike, something like that.
Right, that's what I was going to say. And that's the point, is if there were forces committed, then we have a change here. We have a change in the way that this can be represented. We have a change in the paradigm overall. It now does become a matter of self-defense because then they were literally attacked in their territory. That is a whole other realm of justification. But since that is not there, you have to present it, again, as a righteous conflict, right? So, you know, it's either for culture or for God or, you know, again, I'm not trying to make light of it. I'm just saying that this is just part of the reality. I think this is not thought of consequentially by people that are analyzing this sometimes. And that's right there, boldly evident in this speech, in my mind, unless I'm reading it, you know, incorrectly. What do you think?
It is. It's just that people aren't covering most of the mainstream media. Bits and pieces. I mean, there's some analysis that you'll find. But the news stories, as news stories, the only element of the news story that got covered was the nuclear agreement, weapons agreement.
Right. So continuing on with what is seen domestically, right, what is being represented domestically, again, the major majority, sorry, Larry. I'm trying to do this as soberly as possible, and now I'm tripping over myself.
I could follow along with that, though. I could.
Go ahead. Do it.
No, I mean, when you say major majority, I know what you're saying. I got it.
The majority. All right. Well, anyway, the majority of the speech is dedicated to presenting this idea, to reinforcing previously, released statements and to back up everything that he said up to this point. which would be the standard operating procedure of anybody who is now engaged in a military campaign, regardless of the purpose or the character of it. You would expect this, right? And that's the other thing, is no talk of exactly how this is going to end. There is talk of this is going to continue on. Now, we have the idea that this special military operation is not going to be of a limited or a really short window of time. It's not going to go. It's not going to be over a short period of time at all. And he's saying that too, which I also found surprising. Kind of preparing, I think, the population again for, well, there will be more losses. There will be more time. There will be more of this going on.
He even went as far as to say, you know, Russian industry must be reconfigured mm-hmm. to support the needs of the military in this combat. So we're going to, you know, we're refocusing resources. We're refocusing industry. You know, rather than building a new wave of consumer, the Russian economy and the Russian infrastructure, if you will, is going to be reoriented to fighting this war that does not have, I haven't told you what it's supposed to look like when we win, mm-hmm. you know. So he touched on several elements of the Russian nation and how people are looking around, and that's going to be different too. Right. That it's going to be changed on who's assigned to what role, who's assigned to what companies are assigned to do what. Obviously, companies are going to be switching from things that they're doing. There will be prioritization of resources, whether it's electronic components or, you know. So he really announced without saying it that the nation was going to be converting to a wartime footing.
Right.
And that's a big deal without any, you know, without any really lead in. And obviously, as you're saying, he doesn't want people to stop and think about that. He wants them to immediately jump to the, you know, to a higher ground. Well, of course we have to do this and, you know, suck it up.
What he announced was
far more than the progress of the special military operation.
Well, right. And I'm wondering something else. And this is really the last big, nasty question I have for you, okay? Because I read into things maybe too much sometimes. And I'm saying to myself, look, does a reorientation of the whole of Russian society become necessary if we're just talking about Ukraine and a special operation? If we're talking about war, and he doesn't want to call it a war, still, we're talking about a place the size of Texas, right? Regardless of how much funding is being given or support from NATO or so on and so forth. This change of the entirety of the Russian orientation, to put the nation on a war footing, this suggests to me that this is not the last conflict or the last theater. And this suggests to me that, you know, that he's leaving it open for more to come. Now, maybe this is my old prejudice now beginning to creep up on me. But that's how I take it. Now, do you think I'm going too far? Do you think that that's in there somewhere? Or do you think that that's just a fairly logical possibility or some other answer you have for that?
Well, I think that really implies two things. First of all, mm-hmm. he has reserved for himself the decision on what happens next. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not going to be, if he feels it's necessary to take Moldavia to protect Transnistria, he will do it. There won't be any discussion. Everything now is a military decision. Right? We just put the country on a military footing. So, you know, they're not economic decisions. They're not political. It's military decision that he's going to make. So he's reserved. This has given him the right to reserve a lot of power and broad base. But the other thing it really does is part of that speech talked about the fact that it was going to be an expectation that those who had large amounts of wealth, let's talk oligarchs, would either voluntarily help the state, okay, or that they would be taxed in such a fashion because they could support what the state is doing. I mean, I think maybe you want to talk about this as statism, but the point is that he is literally busting the chops of a class of very wealthy people that he created in the first place. And he is, to some extent, before he might have been just taking a percentage out of what they were getting, you know, as he converted the Soviet Union into a capitalist economy. Now he's taking it back. Mm. That we all thought at the beginning is, well, gee, there is a real power structure in Russia aside from Putin, and it's the oligarchs who've concentrated a lot of wealth and power and run these industry. And actually right now, a lot of them are either deceased or in the process, it looks like, of having their fortunes taken back and their prerogatives of ownership and global travel and holding residences overseas. That he's given them a signal that's ending. Mm-hmm. So that's another major part of what's going on that's received very little notice.
Well, right, and that is not, again, just by the actions of the West, which indeed have, you know, issued sanctions and so on and so forth, and they have captured some of the wealth of the oligarchs. We've seen that, you know, in various reports, right? But this is from within now. Maybe no place safe for these guys to be, who were, again, created by Putin in the first place. You know, given, granted, their position, so to speak. I mean, is it a direct notice, or is it just, look, it's possible. If you don't start to cooperate, this is where we're going. I didn't get that clearly from the speech. I wasn't sure. What do you think of that?
The way I read the speech, it was a notice of it's either voluntary or, you know, you will support this conflict one way or the other. Mm-hmm. If we have to tax you, we'll have to tax you. That's it. And I guess the third element that I'd just like to note, which is a mystery to me, we talked about earlier, is whether or not, so whether any potential conflict between, a power conflict between the Putin and the oligarchs is being handled by Putin. I mean, that's pretty clear. Whether or not there's a real conflict between him and the Wagner Group, or whether Putin has decided he's actually going to use the Wagner Group as a private military force to control the Russian military, which we have seen before in different times and places. You know, maybe what we're seeing is which looks like a challenge to Putin really isn't a challenge to Putin. It's Putin protecting himself from the Russian military via his own, you know, his own military group.
Mm. Well, and then again, the strategic use of weaponizing and then burning an asset is always possible, too. Where, look, you know what, they're in there, they're in power, they've had success. Well, now maybe they suffer some losses. You right. know, just because, look, that is the nature of war, after all. And these guys are definitely ready to do that voluntarily. So, you know, maybe it just works out in the end. Hmm? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
I'm theorizing here. Clearly, I'm speculating, you know, on that.
There's a dynamic there that certainly that we don't understand, but it's a dynamic that didn't exist before.
Right.
So the dynamic that we thought was domestic inside Russia, which was Putin / oligarchs, which is operating dynamic in their economy as it was 12 months ago, is not what it is now. There's a new dynamic between he and Wagner, whatever that might be.
Right. So in closing, Larry, because I know I kept you a little longer than I usually do, but I really appreciate you taking the extra time. What is it? Is there anything we missed here that we should have covered that, again, was not covered. I mean, look, you could easily parrot the stuff that's being said out there and cover this in a very typical way. Or we could go the alt media way and, you know, just talk about, ooh, isn't it terrible that the Western media treats Putin so bad and that's that. We could do that. We could do that. But I'm not doing either one. So what else is rarefied? Because that's what I love talking to you about, is the rarefied information, the things that can be gleaned and observed and understood from what is being projected, certainly, and sometimes what is covert, what is overt, and what is being conducted among many spheres of influence, both politically, militarily, and, of course, in the intelligence communities, which is a serious strong point, a strong suit for you, so to speak. But, you know, Larry-Hancock.com, go there, and I recommend everyone to Larry Hancock's books, period. So I'll give you links to a few. Creating Chaos will definitely be in the link tonight. Seems like we've had to cover that book a whole lot more. I mean, the only thing we've talked about more maybe is the JFK assassination, you and I, but nonetheless, this has become necessary. So
I would say the one thing that stands out, Chuck, to me that we really didn't talk about, there's another dynamic in play here.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere down the road, it's going to be the China-Russia dynamic. Now, everybody's talking about China, U.S. There's something really going on between long-term between China and Russia and how that's going to play.
Well, indeed. And, I mean, look, it's not just because, well, gee, after all, you know, Russia was part of the, was the center of the communist world, and today the center of the communist world is China, so obvious, right? No, I don't think that's it. I think that there's a great more at play here. I think that the only consistency, though, is that they are both still, regardless of what some people think, adversarial to, well, us. that's the only consistency. Whether you like it or not, or whether you think somebody's a hero, or, you know, the Chinese are just misunderstood and they don't really oppress their own people or anything like that. And hey, you know, look, I'm being facetious.
Yeah,
there. That's not me.
That's a long-term dynamic. That's the only, not that we could discuss it now, but it's, as you say, they share something, but if you start looking at their economies as compared to each other, their territory, it becomes a very, and they're on the same continent, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It becomes a very interesting dynamic in terms of, you know, competition, territory, economies. Before it was clear, you know, who was the dominant power and who wasn't, and that's going to have to settle out in the future. But you ask the one thing that, you know, down the road to be thought about or discussed, that's all the discussion in the media is the U.S. and China.
Right.
There's no in-depth discussion of Russia-China long-term.
Right. And I think that's going to become, well, necessary and obvious, and quite frankly, I think you're going to get propagandized. You know, in our media regarding this, I mean, is China the existential threat? Sure, they'll talk about the hacking. They'll talk about, you know, industry and what happened there just a bit. Not really go in depth and talk about how we effectively, you know, did this to ourselves when it comes to China for the most part, in my opinion. Again, that's my opinion, not necessarily that of Larry Hancock's, but, you know, I want to qualify it because Larry might have a different view on this. But largely, I do feel like the precarious position that the United States has placed itself in is just that, a position we placed ourselves in. Regarding China, I think there's a big difference between that and what happened with Russia, although we could be partially responsible for what has gone on here, some of the posturing, some of the positioning, due to the fact that we are a key player with NATO. So, you know, it is what it is. And I almost cringed when you said, you know, why not bring in UN peacekeepers? Because, you know, some people in some parts of the world view them as what? Just an arm, an extension of American influence, right? So there's no impartiality there, according to some people, some people's worldviews, and I'm not going to argue with them. Now, is it controlled by America or somebody else? Well, maybe we could argue about that. But is it just an extension of somebody else's sphere of influence and not necessarily the objective organization I will hear those arguments. You know what I mean? But anyway, all of this is to be seen in the future. And unfortunately, no matter what we do, I think it's going to be revealed. I hope it is not at a high high velocity. Okay, I hope that it is not something that is even more destructive than what we've seen already. And again, I don't support any warfare of any type. I really see it as justified murder, and I don't care what flag what banner is flying above the aggressor. The aggressor is still the aggressor. To me. But again, not necessarily the view of Larry Hancock in any way, shape, or form. But I do want you to check out Larry Hancock's views, his books, his blog, all that, larry-hancock.com. So any parting words or anything you want to make people aware of before I close this one out, Larry?
No, that was pretty much the only thing that occurred to me. And as you say, it will be revealed. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
As time passes. But you know, that's it for me, Chuck.
Great. I'd love to discuss some other stuff with you in the very near future. A bunch of other stuff. But quite frankly, world events keep conspiring to make us discuss things like this. And I think it's very important to get your very sober and very measured view of all of this stuff. Larry Hancock, once again, larry-hancock.com. In Denial, great book. Creating Chaos, great book. Everything authored by Larry Hancock, I recommend. So check it all out on Amazon.com. I'll give you links and a couple other places where you can buy. There's an OR Books link, I think. A few other places. Get Larry Hancock's work because it's always worth it. Thanks again for doing this with me, Larry.
Good to be here, Chuck.
And until tomorrow night, guys, remember, I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.